culturii. An encounter with people of different cultures.
Welcome to Culturii. This is another program in the series, and today we have Dr. Andrea Robles, who is Associate Director of the Center for Social Science Research at the Department of Sociology of George Mason University in the United States. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
So let's start with the first question on your center.
Okay.
What is the exact function of this center?
The center is housed in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and we are an interdisciplinary social science center. And what we hope is to bring in different disciplines around campus to look at different important political and social and economic issues happening in the Northern Virginia, Washington area.
And do you work only for university projects, or you have contracted work being given to you?
Yes, we work both for some university projects, but mostly we have other outside projects that are around the Washington area and also some national survey work that we do. And we are very interested in working with all of the population, so different immigrant groups, different socioeconomic groups. We really try to bring in a variety of different perspectives in the work we do.
Oh, so that's a good introduction, at least, about culture in American universities, the university culture.
Mm-hmm.
This program is about cultures, and I know you come originally from Chile, but you migrated with your parents at a very early
yes.
age.
Mm-hmm.
But having lived in the United States so much,
yeah.
what would you think would be the central values of America, or let's say of Virginia? Because
yeah.
America, or I can frame the question another way. Some
mm-hmm.
people speak of America as a melting pot, others
mm-hmm.
as a solid bowl.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, in terms of culture, do you think America is a melting pot or a solid bowl?
I think it's more of a melting pot from my experience. I mean, you're right. I have a unique perspective because I do come from another country. And so, but I think that is very similar to other people because obviously the U.S. is composed of so many different cultures and languages and ethnic groups and religions. But when I see the values of the U.S., I think that, you know, it varies. It varies among your political views and where you come from. But I think that some of the things that everybody wants, and I think this is worldwide, is for their children to be safe, to have a good education, that family's important. You know, there's some basic values that I think are across all types of groups. So that, I think, is true. But in terms of what people hold as their values, in terms of how they see the world, I think that's really formed by the kinds of ways that they see what is important. So, for example, you know, in the United States, we have the left and the right, mostly the right being Republican, left being more Democratic. And if you ask both people from both parties how they see certain things, you would probably hear very different responses. But I think, again, at the bottom, at the foundation of it, is that people want their families and children to be safe, to be in a good place, that they have family values, so the way they would describe that or define that might be a little different, and that they want to have a place that they feel good about and proud about. So I think that would be
definitely one of the most popular sayings about the United States is the expression, the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
Which is part of its culture. What do the Americans mean when they speak about the American dream? This expression doesn't exist. And for example, a few weeks ago, I had a Russian lady here interviewed,
mm-hmm.
and we spoke that the Russians have the idea the expression Great Russia, which essentially means the national sense of identity which unifies different ethnic groups in Russia. So what do the Americans mean when they speak about the American dream? Many Europeans don't have any idea what the American dream is.
Well, the American dream, I think, has shifted a little bit because the U.S., just like other countries in Europe, are facing some economic issues. And so I think when people used to say the American dream, they meant that they were able to start no matter where they were in terms of education, in terms of culture, in terms of language, and that they would be able to decide that they wanted to have a profession or have a shop or have anything that they wanted to do, and they would be able to, with hard work, get there. And I think that was the American dream, that you could have an idea of what you wanted to be, and no matter where you came from, that was possible. So it wasn't so much who you knew, it wasn't so much whether you came from a very wealthy family, but that anyone could have that dream. And I think that's something that I know motivated or has motivated many immigrants that I know from Chile. They see the U.S. as a place that no matter what you are, a fisherman or a teacher, you could come to the U.S. and make something of what you want for yourself and for your family. Now, with the economic downturn, I think that's become a little harder. It's not as simple, and I think that I don't hear that phrase as much as I used to. So the question would be
the president,
right? So the question would be, what do other people and other countries who want to immigrate to the U.S. do they still see the U.S. as a place of possibility? And I'm not sure.
Within this framework, mm-hmm. How would Americans in general look at a person who, through no fault of his own, has failed to become a success in a sense? Through no fault of his own, because we know that every part in the world mm-hmm. tends to look at deviants and so on, more or less in the same manner.
Right.
Some countries in a harsher way, others in a more mm-hmm. humane way, but we still look at deviants by definition as deviants.
Right.
But I'm not referring to these. I'm referring to people who worked hard, mm-hmm. but unfortunately they had failed.
Mm-hmm.
So how normally do the Americans look at these
things? Okay, so again, the economic downturn, I think, has brought a shift to how people are thinking. Because I think when the U.S. was doing well economically, and you had a lot of people doing well, I think if they saw especially poverty, because I know it's hard to imagine that the U.S. has a lot of poverty, but it does. And so you would see someone who maybe wasn't as educated or couldn't find a job, and people would say, oh, that's something that they did wrong, maybe that they have different values, you know, they would put that person down. But now so many families that at one point had good jobs and a middle class life where they had homes and they had insurance and they had all the things that the American dream, you would want from an American dream, a lot of people have lost their jobs, they've lost their homes. And I think now people look at that and say, no matter what that person did right or wrong, they were still one of those unlucky people who might have lost their job. So I have a feeling that right now, again, because of the economic downturn, because they see their neighbors who've lost their houses and lost things, that it wasn't so much their fault. It was just that a company lays off 1,000 people and you happen to be one of those 1,000. I think right now people are looking at that with a little bit more understanding than some years ago.
We know that America is perhaps the strongest and the largest capitalist economy in the world, one of the richest, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And together with some other countries, like Germany, Japan, mm-hmm. Britain, it always had been a very resilient economy in a sense. They go to a downturn, but then they find a way to go up. I mean, and we are discussing the economy here from a cultural point of view.
Uh-huh.
What do you think makes the American people make these turns? I mean, if we look at the Great Depression of the late 20s, and how America after that had the enough money to fight the Second World War, because basically she paid for the second, for the expenses of not only of the Second World War, but for the regeneration of Europe after the First World War, after the Second World War through the Marshall Plan. So how, I mean, does it come because it has a lot of raw materials, a lot of hardworking people, population perhaps relatively small to the size of the country, or a culture, a Calvinistic culture, which makes people work hard? What is it really?
What is it that makes the U.S.
the economy so resilient economically?
Resilient, yeah. Well, people are debating this right now in terms of whether, what kinds of policies, what kinds of, how do we move forward from an unemployment, which doesn't sound like a lot maybe in other countries, if we, but when we have 8% unemployment, 9%, 10%, we almost got to 10%, that's a lot in the United States. And there, again, the U.S. is not monolithic. There are pockets where we may have 45% unemployment in certain communities, and in other places like Washington has been less touched by it, so it's a lower unemployment rate. So what can make the economy move forward and what makes it resilient? And so I think from an economic standpoint, you know, you have people arguing about what kind of policies, interest rates, what to do with the social safety net, whether people should be provided unemployment insurance or unemployment benefits while they're out of work, whether that would then make people lazy and not want to work. That's another argument. But there, but you know, the problem is where are the jobs and how to move forward with that. And so, you know, I don't know from what perspective, you know, how that resiliency. But I think it's probably, you know, the U.S. is made up of a lot of people who feel that, that they're entrepreneurs. And so what you end up happening is, even though a lot of larger companies are firing people or letting people go, you have a lot of people saying, okay, well, I can't do anything. I can't, I don't have that job any longer, but I'll go out to the street and can some fruit and sell marmalade. And so you have a lot of people trying to be creative in terms of doing some small business that they may not have done before.
So people, if they are in difficulty, don't look at it as being, say, below their status to do certain jobs.
Well, I
think they start from the beginning always.
I think you're finding that maybe at one point people would have thought that, but now, since there are so many people in that position, people are willing to do whatever it takes to go ahead, to go ahead. So you will hear people who maybe before were successful in terms of a business, but now are needing to, like I said, go to the farmer's market on a Saturday and sell their tomatoes. And people will be doing that and starting to create other small businesses or micro businesses.
I know you've been researching on poverty. And definitely the fact that, as we, as I have been saying, I think that the United States is still a very rich country, in spite of downturn in the economy after the crack which has happened in the banking system and in the building system. And the so America still remains. I mean, Lehman Brothers had said that it could pay its debts back in 3 years. I mean, so I mean, that's very quick in a sense. Certain banks in Britain did the same. How do you explain that? In the United States, there is so much poverty that there is a philosophy that the safety net should be a self-insured type of safety net rather than socially provided safety net as we know it in Europe. And we try to do that, it seems that in the United States they immediately will call you a socialist, while in Europe it's taken as a for granted matter of fact which any government wouldn't dare touch. In a sense, how do you explain this difference in culture, especially that when the American Constitution was being drawn, the founding fathers of the United States were greatly influenced by the French Enlightenment, for example?
Right. No, it's very hard. I actually see what you have here in Malta, and I find it wonderful. And I feel that way when I, travel. And also, for example, the World Bank, I was involved with a program called the Rapid Social Response, which is a fund, a trust fund, that's trying to build social safety nets in low-income countries. And I mean the lowest, the more poor countries, to try to figure out a safety net for the poorest of the poor. And then we have the U.S., who right now is not competing. The candidates do not compete on who's going to build a better social net, but they're competing with who's going to dismantle the social safety net at a time when so many people are using that as a way of survival. So for me, it's a paradox. I don't quite understand how, again, given the amounts of people who are losing their jobs, who need food benefits, they're called food stamps, who need insurance that's provided by the state, that they, the candidates, especially right now with the Republican primaries, are trying to say, you know, the one who thinks they're going to do better is actually getting rid of some of those programs. It goes against a lot of what we see happening in the rest of the world. So,
I appreciate another issue, which is, in a sense, it doesn't happen only in the United States, mm-hmm. but it's a picture. You're a sociologist, and mm-hmm. if we look at political economy in the world, it seems that there is a certain sense of, I don't know, sense of self-survival in the richest countries. So I'm going to ask for your opinion without tempting you to be unpatriotic in a sense. I mean, for example, if we look at the United Nations, United Nations agencies, at the European Union, I mean, the founding countries of the United Nations say that there is United Nations in New York, which makes a lot of money for New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a multiplier effect.
Right.
I mean, you've got the World Bank in Washington, which mm-hmm. again, it has a large multiplier effect. Suppose we were to house the World Bank in Malta. I'm sure that will help the Maltese economy a lot without giving a penny directly to the Maltese economy, but only by its multiplier effect, by people visiting Malta to visit the World Bank. It's the same thing as if you are having the Pope here. I mean,
that's
many
right.
people visit Malta because of the Pope. Same thing happened as regards the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Brussels was in the situation it was, and it was a peaceful country, so it became the center of Europe, but they wanted to give something to Luxembourg, so the European Parliament meets in two places, in Salzburg, one session here, one session there.
Mm-hmm.
There are some institutions in Luxembourg, there are the FAO in Rome, there is as regards the United Nations, you've got the WHO, I don't know, the UNESCO mm-hmm. was in France, the WHO, I think it's in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that there is a cake, and the rich people took care to take the best part of it and leave the crumbs to the rest. I mean, how do you look at this issue, which is not mm-hmm. typically American, but from which America is gaining immensely? It's enough to say that anybody working with the United States, when they go outside America, they don't pay with Visa or with MasterCard, but they pay with American Express. I've noticed this infallibly. They cash out with an American Express that is making money for you, for the United States. And would it be fairer to put that in a third country, in a third world country? Not even more than one, but I think if some world agency were to come here, it would change a bit of a picture, especially in the service industry.
Right.
And in a country, for example, like Malta, which has no raw materials,
uh-huh.
and all the thing it has is brawn and brain, but not more than that, and the brain is developing a lot, as you can see from this mm-hmm. university. So,
what
how come this isn't part of an American conscience? On the other hand, you know, the Americans mm-hmm. try to give all sorts of aid, be it military and be it peaceful.
Right.
In a sense, the United States, while wanting to be the policeman, it is my impression, and I told you, I'd like you to comment freely. I mean, I don't want you to be mm-hmm. unpatriotic. I think the United States is ready to play the policeman of the world, but mm-hmm. in a sense, it's not very well at distributing where money really is.
Well, I have a few things to say about it. I mean, I think that when you talk about these large international organizations, you know, you're right. I mean, why is it that they ended up where they did? And obviously, who was in control at the time that this happened, right? And I know that right now there is some debates going on to try to make the majority of the World Bank or the people who head the World Bank to change that so that there's more say in terms of developing countries and such. But I think of a quote that I saw in terms of that in every first world country, in every third world country, there's the first world, right? In the sense that there are some elite, in no matter what country that you're in, that are making the rules and having the power and having the money. But I want to say, in terms of the general American public, I think people aren't even aware of this. You know, they're not aware of these multinational company, these international organizations. I mean, you know, if you think of how people go about their daily life in most of the U.S., this is not something they even think about. So in terms of the American public, the general American public, these aren't issues that even, you know, that they think of. But then you have the elites, and who are the elites, and who are they made up of? And I think those kinds of negotiations that happen, it's not something I can necessarily comment on, but yeah, it would be great to have something in Malta or something in other countries. And I know the development banks have different offices located in different places. I also know that the UN has CEPAL in Chile, and they have another larger organization, another large office, I think, in Kenya, possibly. I'm not quite sure. So I think that's just a little piece, given how the world is divided. But like I said, I just don't think the general American person that you would speak to would even have an opinion on that.
What is the place of the family in American culture?
The
place of the family.
The place
in
of
American
the family.
Culture.
You mean where, how people view the family?
That's it, and how they treasure it or not.
Yes. Well, no, I think, like in everywhere, I feel no matter what the socioeconomic class is, no matter where I've traveled, the family is a very important part of any kind of society. It's the stability. And when families aren't doing well, I think the country as a whole isn't doing as well. And I think one of the things that, again, has happened in this economic downturn is that families have really relied on each other in a way that maybe they haven't before. I mean, in the U.S., usually when kids turn 18, they go off to college, or if they're not going to college, they go and get an apartment, and they just recognize that they're going to get their job and move forward. And now what you see is many generations coming together to try to provide that safety net. So you have a lot of college students who are not able to get jobs coming back and living with their family. You have grandparents moving in with children. So that issue of family, where before you only saw that more with immigrant populations, you see more of this kind of generational, intergenerational situation happening that just wasn't as common before.
What do Americans detest most? Perhaps in their own country and in the world. I mean, what would be the greatest crime in the United States, for example? By common opinion, I mean, not by law, by common consensus. If you ask a common man what he would like to avoid in life, or his children, what does his children want? What does he want his children to avoid?
Well, I think safety of person, I would say. You know, I think
threat to
one's
life and limb.
Yeah, I would think. And that's why I believe that when 9/11 happened in the U.S., you know, the U.S. had been lucky; things hadn't happened in their soil. I mean, I come to Malta and see how, throughout its history, how it's been colonized, how there's been wars, how so much has happened in your land, and the U.S. was just not used to something like that happening. It was always someone else's place. It was always someone else's land, and I think 9/11 really brought it home that this can happen here, and I think that has caused a certain consciousness of that has not all been good. I mean, people have, you know, Muslims feel more threatened. as an immigrant, I remember thinking that life was getting better for immigrants, for Latinos, and now I feel a backlash, especially in the Washington area. There's counties where they can pull you over, and they say that it's not for being Latino, but if they see you're darker skinned, they may pull you over. So now what you see happening is that in order to protect, you know, yourself, people are reacting in ways that might not be what you would hope from the U.S.
One last question, because with only 2 minutes remaining, mm-hmm. less than 2 minutes, 1 minute more.
Mm-hmm.
What is the state of interethnic relations in the United States at present?
Interethnic relationships. Well, you know, the U.S., like you said in the beginning, is a melting pot. And I think that for the most part, you know, people want to get along, and they can see the value of that. And again, I think 9/11 kind of interrupted that a bit. But I'd like to say that I think it depends on the place. I mean, in urban areas where you have a lot of cultures, you have a lot of languages, where I am in Washington, in Fairfax County, it's unbelievable. You know, any school can have 80 languages. There's a lot of emphasis and trying to promote different cultures and different language. But then you might go off to a more rural area where that's not as common, and so you would have more tensions.
Dr. Robles, thank you very much for participating in this program, and wish you well on your trip back to the United States.
And thank you so much. I love your country.
Thank you.